The following program was produced by an independent community producer. The opinions expressed do not necessarily reflect those of the ECAT staff or board of directors.
Good evening and welcome to the March 2024 edition of For the Love of Words. I'm your host, John Holgerson, and along with my co-host, Pamela Almquist-Olson, tonight we welcome David P. Miller. David P. Miller's collection, Bend in the Stair, was published by Lilly Poetry Review Books in 2021. Sprawled Asleep was published by Nix's Mate Books in 2019. His poems have received Best of the Net and Pushcart nominations and have appeared in Meat for Tea, Lilly Poetry Review, Leon Literary Review, Solstice, Salamander, Riddled with Arrows, Nix's Mate Review, and Jerry Jazz Musician, among other journals. His poems, And You and Interview, were included in an issue of the British journal Magma, focused on teaching poetry to secondary school students. He will be a featured reader at the Newton Free Library in Newton, Massachusetts, on April the 9th, 2024, at 7 p.m. Welcome, David.
Thank you very much, John. It's great to be here. Such a pleasure.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So I start with most of the poets who are on the program. What was it that initially brought you to poetry?
Yeah, I didn't really start writing poetry seriously until I was in my mid-50s, which is a good deal later than is the case for many people. I've been a poetry reader for my entire life, and a fairly intense poetry reader since about my mid-30s, beginning with reading a lot of poetry pretty much every day. But it wasn't until my 50s that, and there's kind of a long backstory, which, you know, I'm sure we don't have time for, but essentially I took a couple of workshops just out of curiosity, without thinking that I was going to start writing poetry. And out of these workshops, I began to get the idea of, well, you know, gee, maybe I could actually do this as well as intensely read in poetry daily. So it came in kind of sideways, in a way. That's basically it, yeah.
Well, when you were reading poetry intensely in your 30s, who were you reading?
Oh, geez, everybody.
who were your influences?
Okay. So in terms of contemporary, and let's stretch that term and talk about, say, 20th and 21st century.
Okay.
That's a big gap.
It's a big
time period. Reading all over the place. I mean, names that come to mind right off: Wesley McNair, Patricia Smith, Tracy K. Smith, Ada Limone. Although in the 90s, I wasn't reading them. I was reading, Anne Waldman. It kind of escapes me now. I mean, I have at home shelf after shelf after shelf after shelf after shelf of, you know, poetry books, most of them having been read since the
right.
90s.
Right.
Which is to say that I try to be, not try to be, I find myself being pretty eclectic in terms of how I read.
Okay.
Yeah. But there's another thing about influences, though. I was thinking about this. If we go all the way back to my childhood, influences that are actually still with me now are A.A. Milne, Edward Lear, Lewis Carroll, and Robert Louis Stevenson. So those are really my early poetry influences.
Yeah.
And particularly Milne and Carroll and Lear really stay with me. I mean, I don't write the way they do, you know, but they're still with me.
So speaking of not necessarily how you write, but what you write, what would you say the most consistent theme is in your work?
I find that I am mostly writing family stories, autobiographical stories, but I have written, particularly the first book, Sprawled Asleep, has a lot of poems in it about encounters on public transportation, for example. I live in Boston, and you know, when I was, I'm retired now, but when I was working, that was a very common situation. So those kinds of personal stories I write a lot, but I also write really from sort of observation of natural events. Even one that I wrote a little while back about a spider, not an uncommon topic, but yeah, a spider who had spun a web on our porch, and then, you know, and then I didn't see this happening, but then it was gone the next day, and then she re-spun it again. You know, which is phenomenal, actually, when you think about it. So that's probably the most typical type of content. Yeah.
The family poetry that you write, when you said that, I thought of Sylvia Plath. Mm. not necessarily that you write exactly the same type of family poetry that she did.
I don't think so.
Okay. But when we talk about family in poetry, it can be anything from Sylvia Plath to Mary Oliver, so I just thought I'd ask that question.
Oh, yeah. Where would I be on that spectrum? Jeez,
yeah.
that's hard. I think what I find myself doing when I'm writing family poetry, which includes, for example, stories about meeting my wife, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's not only about my parents and so on, it's also about my grandparents. What I find is that I'm looking back into these stories to sort of explain them for someone who might be interested in knowing about them, but also it's like, what does this continue to mean now? What does this continue to mean now? To me now? And what, in looking backwards, what is it that is still alive, that is still real for me now?
Right.
That reminds me, I'll throw this in. I also have I find increasingly, I have a number of poems that are about things and possessions, actually about objects. But I'm finding that kind of resonates a lot with the autobiographical stuff, because any given object, you know, if it's a meaningful object, you know, carries a history that I can keep looking into and looking into.
And I was just about to say, the way you're describing your family poetry, it sounds like you're writing somewhat of a personal history and its impact on the present, as well as what happened in the past.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're recording that sentiment, if you will, in your family poetry.
And hoping that, and you know, this is so often the case, that a personal story
has a universal note.
Voila. Right? Because people, even if it's not their exact history, it's like, that makes me think of. And when that happens, when that connection happens, it's extremely gratifying.
Yes, yeah. I agree.
Yeah, and when I read some poems later, I'll be including some of those.
Now, let's talk a little bit about poetic structure. What are the different types of poetry, the different forms of poetry that you're drawn to?
Wow, yeah. Now, in terms of forms, first thing I think of when we talk about forms, and this is the way I put it, forms that have names, right?
Okay,
right?
Yes.
Because, okay, so sonnet has a name.
Right.
Sestina has a name. I'm fond of sestinas. I'm fond of pantoums.
Villanelles?
I'm not so fond of villanelles. There are some very fine villanelles, but
they're hard to write.
They're hard to write, and I'll let it go with that for fear of offending anyone. I'm not so fond of villanelles. But pantoums, sestinas, and I've attempted a number of pantoums and sestinas, but there are also forms that are more that are less well known, but that are definitely formal because they have constraints. Are you familiar? You may very well be with the golden shovel form. Have you heard of it?
No, actually, I haven't heard.
Okay, so there's kind of backstory to that too, and we don't have time for that backstory either. But essentially, with the golden shovel, you take an existing text. It might be an entire poem. If it's a short poem, it might be a song lyric. It might be. And all right, so let's say, just to make it easy, let's say that your existing text is roses are red, violets are blue. This is not something I've used. roses are red, violets are blue, six words, right? You have a six-line poem. Your first line ends with roses. Your second line ends with R. Third line ends with red. And it goes through. Yeah. This would, now that's a simplistic thing, but that was really developed by the poet Terence Hayes not so very long ago. These are being increasingly written. It sounds like kind of a game, but actually if you get into it, it's quite challenging to do it well. Well, that's a form. It's not a form a lot of people know, but it's so. But I wouldn't call myself overall a formal poet because I do a lot of still what's called free verse. Yeah.
Tonight you're going to be reading from Bend in the Stair.
Right.
And so what as to form, what would you call the poems that most of the poems that are in the book?
Most of the poems I would call free verse. They have, depending on what the poem is, I mean, they'll have a formal constraint in when I was writing them, but this is a really private matter when I was writing this. Like, I'm going to put some limits on myself, and that'll get me to write the poem, but I don't expect readers or listeners to go, ah, yes, I get that. You know, it's just, it's what's underneath it, you know, structurally.
We will find out, because the audience, I think, will be very, very enchanted and enraptured by your work. I have the privilege of having heard you read very recently, and I think the audience is really going to enjoy your recitations tonight.
Great.
So thank you so much for coming.
Thanks, John. Thank you.
I'm going to start with a poem that I often open with. My wife and I live in Jamaica Plain in a house that was built in the early 1890s, and this is about that. From a house. I come from a house built within whiff of breweries now corked, set at the crotch of a valley whose brook now runs within tubes. House laughing with tailors, machinists, and trainmen, brooding with knitters, waiters, furniture movers. Birthday full of chauffeurs and ironworkers, vacated by painters, insurance clerks, stagehands. I come from a house traded and kept by Doyle, Ryan, Daly, multiple Murphys, by and by Zuber and Zwerdling, doorbelled with Jaime, Rosado, Vasily, rent fretted by Baez, Hirakaus, Van Loy, trudged home and paced overhead by Dugan, Rodriguez, Solcida, where homecomers shook off their days of National Shawmut, Somerset Hotel, Frank's Lunch, Chimes Brownies, wafted their dinners, or scoop them from cans. I come from a house where I came to my she out of thin air, my karate heroine, siren of newspaper personals. I come from a house of quadruple mortgages when flappers verged on bread lines, a house whose glass eyed downy flake donuts, house shield distilled spirits, Roxbury mattress, a pox after that of emptying lots. I come from a house bought out from under city condemning, its price nailed to the porch, upper third hollowed of walls and plumbing. A house with decades of martial art foot landings massaged hard into blonde polish that held itself free from sparks from the torched mattress, nay, stringed instrument factory. The lot's palimpsest soil turned up tubes of catgut. I come from a house with bedroom, carpeted floor to ceiling, a flipped shower where cold is code word for hot. A house where four now go out and come back with a homebody mouse. Surprised in the kitchen, it dives down a burner. A house rooted on thickness of pudding stone. A house that shares the water of earth in its basement. A house that stirs in its sleep with the passage of night trains. I should have mentioned, but I will not mention it now, that I'm reading from my book, Bend in the Stair. Probably all of the ones that I'll be reading are from Bend in the Stair. We will go over to, I have about three poems in the book that are titled Porches, and they have different subtitles. I'm gonna read two of them. This is a poem in two parts. Porches, Wisteria and Its Little Brother. One. rooted thick as a welder's forearm. Our wisteria sprawls green across the chain link above the sunken yard. In naked months, its skeleton charts a delirious family tree. When too long untrimmed, it beckons toward ears of passersby. We find tendrils ripped away, hurled to the sidewalk. The fence's bottom edge wrenches out of plumb. Wisteria has a fetish for the lonely elderly. Its first caress with infant's finger seeks the least crevice beneath the eaves, the most modest gap in window frame. It's a patient, tender romance, one shingle eased from the next, body dismembered, plank from desiccated plank. At last, its barked tentacles, grape cluster pendant tresses, cuddle wrap the empty house. Glassy-eyed, the house forgets to fix its face, forgets to shave or tie its shoes, sits in the seedy yard, pants around its ankles. 2. The potted morning glory on the porch, unstaked this year, thrashes in slow time. Its feelers grope a silent paramour, the beach chair is set beside it. It's an asymmetric love affair. Twinings wrap a boa through the frame. New blossoms push between the webbing. I might have napped in open air this afternoon, found a tentacle at my throat. A number of the poems in this book have to do with my parents, and particularly my father. This poem is in two parts as well. Sun rises with my father. 1. My father, settled in a place where he could walk outdoors all year, made it his pleasure to help the old folks. Retired, but barely stepped across that definite senior discount line, he rose each Florida's pre-dawn, traced on foot the route the paper boys followed to fling the Sarasota Herald Tribune lightly at the ends of driveways. If these neighbors were the definite elders, my parents were numbered among the youngers. He knew the old, old ones by name, knew which of them needed their news carried to their porches. Warmth and moisture soothed his lungs, grown rasping with Massachusetts freeze. 20 minutes walk before the sun burst out, with its own baggage, helped to shrink a belly pointlessly enlarged. I wanted to know something beyond the tourist guides about this place, so easy, soft, and alien. Some mornings are visits near the solstice, those shortened days oddly considered cold. I'd rise and dress in darkness, shielding my wife's shut eyes against marauding light, fumble to the living room to meet him. Off we'd set, do-gooders at the end of night, return for coffee, as bands of red lifted above the roofs. 2. 20 years downstream, my father, a widower, one of the elder elders, still met the early hours before I cared to. I'd fumble out to meet him, his head crooked back on the rose-pink recliner, shut-eyed after a first caffeine. The other old olds now fended on their own for headlines dropped at their driveway's ends. The younger elder, I stepped into light for one minuscule good deed, fetched the paper for his second waking, or his third. Another Porches poem goes back to the house of my late in-laws on Long Island. In Huntington, and here we are. Porches on Chatham Place in memory of Marjorie Wood Wiley, 1921 to 2020. A sodden June morning, notebook clumsy on my lap, settled on a metal tube rocking chair, its arthritic frame inclines backward, thwacks itself forward. The porch is overhung enough to sit outside, watch rain plummet thick. Pen to paper, interrupted by a rabbit at the holly tree, working its jaws, an engine slurping up the greens. It lopes the driveway's edge. Infant robins amplify their starved pleading. A parent bird docked at the nest shoves some dangling item into an offspring maw. We found this nest outside my wife's childhood bedroom window. We've returned home to her mother, who remains indoors, watched over by her aide from bed to couch to table. Nestlings quiet as mother or father rockets diagonally over my corner of the roof. A parrot uproots a worm, drops it on the walk, confirms, grapples it again. Another unfledged outburst from beaks gaping, famished in the shrub. Write or watch, exposed and dry, curtained with rain. The same bird flies again on its same tangent. The morning steps ahead as the parents cross off their feed babies item, then add it back. Behind the door, we set a day's first coffee. It gurgles in wait for her mother's waking. The next one is about a pair of natural objects that I have around the house that I'm particularly fond of. Quartz driftwood. One. This milky quartz stone, each jag and ledge buffed by the ocean, answers the light from my eyes as it settles my hand. Lifted from the pebble-stippled sand of a vineyard beach, its interior spark ebbed in the wet but glimmers now as I turn it beneath the table lamp. Flat-bottom wedge, mounded like the old hills we call mountains. It fits the clutch of my palm, cools the heart line, the mind line, the life and fate lines as they close around it. Fever's antidote. It returns no heat. Molten magma crystallized. Permanent ice. Two. Driftwood. Bent like a seahorse, head and tail. Striated, it holds the living branches' lines of force. The trees reach toward the sun, engraved in its double twist. Three potato-eyed wounds rise where offspring twigs were lost. Creases in its bends like skin set in permanent furrows. Where it's severed from the tree, the cratered gash is soft, a caress. It receives my hand's heat. I stroke this creature, held against my ear. Its voice, hollow and low, might be the sigh of my fingers against grain. 1 poem that goes to Burlington, Vermont, and to the home of my late mother's parents, my grandparents, and a couple of objects, more than a couple of objects, that returned home to my home from their home. Dinosaur. Pterodactyl in bronze. Patina mellows your wings and belly. Centered in my palm, your wingtips press the flesh of thumb and little finger. Immovable in flight, tabletop glider. How do I deserve you? Remnant memory of my professor grandfather's study. When I was a boy, I found you on his desk, held you, felt myself, even more his grandson. You and the dainty woolly mammoth, ruffed of wood, I lifted him, held him to my nose. Both of you, calm oddments of prehistory, sleepers at night with the genetics journals. What allowed me to carry you away when my grandparents departed? 34 years after the next owners filled that house with themselves, I drive past. The front porch is walled, its street face shut. Something inside must still know me. The bend in the stair, ascending to the study, knows who I was, remembers the extinct creatures. I took the maple dining chairs and table. I have the 17th century Bible, the mammoth, I took you, burnished dinosaur, green in my hand. One question I have about my ashes. Will they still listen? This intact body pictures itself a relentless listener, as when remote voices, nine stories down the well of a hotel atrium, find a crack beneath the door. They creep to the bedside and watch me at night. The body said, I can't sleep, applies stoppers to its ears, sets room air low and steady. This body can set to hibernate when sound is plain, constant, but still it hears, hears. Imagine this chassis gone to motes, running after vibration, the music of every object. One mote absorbs what comes just before the chrysalis cracks. Another hears the broom standing in place by the pantry. Magazine page lifted back into air after folding. A sigh before soil shifts toward the furrow. An ash picks up a paint chip's unlatch before it falls from the fan light to the porch. What the air says after the clock hand shifts. Small sounds, no longer obliviated by solid, bungling ears. Three hearts. The pelican tips its fish-filled gut bucket bill to its breast to press out the last morsels. The Dalmatian kind rests its blood-red port pouch, sagging crimson on its chest. The old religious made Christ of these. They saw mother birds pierce their hearts raw open to feed their fainting young. If someone pulls a night blanket's extra thickness above his heart, is it that he lacks a piece of quartz to dull the ache? If at the morning table, easing eyes of the blue stoneware lamp, he rests a hand an extra minute over that place near the breastbone, is the hand a shield? Armor wrapped against an average cliff edge day? Or a motionless caress? An embrace of coming strikes, punctures, spills. The esoteric heart is called anahata, unstruck. It sounds without collision. Unhurt, it opens bare to all assaults. Unbeaten, say the mystics. Such image halos the muscle, certain in the chest, that beats itself till death.
There's a storm.
Join me, Priscilla Almquist-Olsen, to explore the town of Easton and its interesting, engaging, ordinary, and extraordinary people, and meet a smorgasbord of guests, including artists, authors, musicians, business owners, community organizations, clergy, local leaders, etc., etc., etc. Community Forum at 3 p.m. on Thursdays and 1:30 p.m. on Saturdays. See you then.
Welcome to Service Matters, a weekly radio show that talks about the good things that are happening in local communities and beyond.
Since 1978, the Easton Food Pantry has been dedicated to providing food to our neighbors in times of need. As long as there's a hungry people in our community, our doors are open, our hearts will be open to help.
We also like to talk about the good things that people do to make a difference, and in many cases, to make dreams real for folks out there in need.
Just to chat about, as you say, some of the good things in life, some of the good things, the great things, and the happy things.
And certainly watch us on ECAT, Easton Community Access Television.
You You want to get involved in an exciting race around historic Northeastern? Apply to be on Expedition Easton, a local version of the amazing race produced by ECAT. This summer, six pairs, 12 contestants, will get the chance to compete for the grand prize. All ages are welcome, but each pair must have one member over 18 years old. Think you got what it takes to complete the expedition? Email info@eastoncat.org or call us at 508-230-7200. Casting has begun. Dates are set for June 22nd, 23rd, 29th, and 30th.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, residents of Easton, friends and neighbors. This is Bill Ames,
co-host with Priscilla Almquist Olson of The Film Connection.
On ECAT now for over 20 years. We're very proud of that.
And we like to interview guests from Easton who have been involved in the film business.
Actors, producers. We're very fortunate today to have a producer of a film.
Oh, I didn't see you there.
Sick of all the new shows and movies dominating pop culture? Well, have no fear, because old-time movie and old-time TV are here, where we like to add our own flair.
There's a truck out front, and if we could just get the keys...
Man, are you crazy? Are you out of your mind? Those are flesh-eating zombies. They upended our car, okay? We're lucky to be alive, especially Joe. I had to pull him out of the trunk, for crying out loud.
It's been a long day.
Also, make sure to check out the Radiocast, our accompanying podcast where we talk about what we've watched.
There was a lot of moments of just Mac on the raft going down the river, just internal monologuing over and over and over.
We show the classics and nothing but the classics. Well, except for the weird ones. Check us out on all our channels as well as our YouTube.
Welcome to For the Love of Words. I'm Priscilla Almquist Olson, your host, and today... my guest is Ed Begley from Ohio, a musician, songwriter, and a very delightful personality. And so, Ed, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me on, Priscilla.
Oh, you're so welcome.
I appreciate it.
Okay, tell me a little bit about your background, your childhood, and if there were any influences in your childhood which brought you on this path.
My dad was a pretty famous, like, underground musician here in our area. So I grew up when I was a kid, you know, just going and seeing him play a lot of different honky tonks. And I never thought I'd wind up playing with him. You know, I wound up playing with him many years later. But he was just... Pretty much most of my career has been in that kind of aspect. We played a lot of honky tonks and stuff like that. So I was probably in high school, and I picked up the bass in high school. There was some girl I liked that liked musicians. So I was like, well, I like her. So maybe if I start playing an instrument, she'll start digging me. And we did date for a little while, but anyways. But my dad was like, hey, you know, you've been playing this rock and roll music. At that time, I was playing like in a Christian rock band. He goes, won't you come play with me? At least you'll make some money. So I started playing with him probably in 1989, I believe. And it was pretty interesting. Our first show was in Indiana, and it was on some stage, and it had chicken wire around it. So I was thinking, what in the world did I get myself into? So that was my start into my country music scene.
And how old were you then?
I was probably 17 years old. But back then, it was different. It was like when I used to go see him as a kid, these honky-tonks, if you went in with your mom, they weren't like, hey, what do you got that kid in here for? So it was the same way then. I was playing with him. I was underage, but nobody was IDing you or anything like that. I was getting up on stage and playing and like, well, he's with the band. He must be of age, you know? So it was one of those kind of things.
Yeah. And what were some of the songs that you played back then?
We played a wide variety, and it was pretty tough back then because shows were from 9 to 2:30 in the morning. So there were long nights, and that's whenever I heard people talking about the Beatles and Hamburg, I got that whole scene because we used to play out three nights a week, and it was from 9 to 2:30 in the morning. And we played a wide variety. We played everything from Percy Sledge to Make the World Go Away, songs like that, and just a lot of old country. But we were developing in that same period our own unique originals and sounds as we were playing. So I would say the early stages, we went under different names, though, because we weren't, even though we were playing, we'd play some places and we'd come in as Little Chicago. And we would be so horrible starting off sometimes that they wouldn't have us back, and we would change the band name and we'd come back as something else, but we'd be a little bit better the next time around. And then we kept doing it till we were like top notch. And then I'd say it was like 93, 94, we were like, we need to pick a band, you know, a band name we're going to stick with because we're pretty decent now. And I came up with the name, like, I was like, what about Psycho Hillbilly? And my dad goes, I don't know about that. He goes, what about Tattoo Billy? And I was like, yeah, Tattoo Billy, that's got a good ring to it. And that's what we went with.
Yeah. And now you're still known as Tattoo Billy, right?
Yeah. Well, when we first started off, I was the only guy in the whole band that had tattoos. So it was, everybody thought I was Billy, and I didn't catch on to it. Everybody kept coming, hey, Billy, hey, Billy. And I was like, my name's Ed, you know. And my dad was like, he was kind of like, roll with that. You'll be Billy. And that's how I kind of turned into the mascot of the band, you know. But now I'm kind of the only surviving original member. So it's definitely my stage name now that I go under.
Uh-huh. Wow. So from those early days, have you retained any of the music that you played then?
We do, but I'm kind of like, it's one of those parts in, as an artist that you love what you did in the past. We recorded a lot of songs and done a lot of things, but it's like you come to a point where I'm in a rebranding stage of Tattoo Billy. We're coming out, and my dad was the main lead vocalist, and now that he's passed on, I'm like, you know, so these songs that I sent you today are just me singing. And I'm fortunate enough, my wife sings too, so she helps me out. And she actually did a version of Frisky Whiskey 2 that you can look up on YouTube. She did a version, you know, with her singing it too. So she's a good singer. I call her the good singer. I'm just, I try to sing.
So you have a very musical family. And so do you have any kids?
No, unfortunately, I don't. I have my wife, I passed away in 2014, and I've been remarried. But out of both of those marriages, I've had stepkids that I keep in contact with. They think of me as their father. And mm-hmm. So, you know, basically, they're my kids, but I'm their stepdad. But
yeah,
no kids of my own.
I'm so sorry for your loss. And, but, you know, so your musical gene that you got from your dad was a real coup for you because it created the rest of your life, the path that you've been on. And so tell me a little bit about that journey. What are you doing today that reflects a little bit about what you did in earlier years?
Well, it was pretty neat. Like with me and Dad, we played, and Dad knew a lot of people in the music industry. So like when he passed away, Little Texas sent flowers to his funeral and stuff like that. Because Del Gray from Little Texas, he's the drummer and one of the lead songwriters for that band. He was a fan of my dad's voice. He liked my dad's voice. But my dad grew up with another guy named Randy Hayes, and he was the lead guitar player for Keith Whitley, one of the all-time great country singers. And so I got to, you know, get around a lot of these, like Randy, his name's Randy Hayes, and we did some of our recordings down there, our early recordings, and he did backups, and some of them he played guitar, and so it was really neat just, you know, to get around these individuals that had a track record like that. And today it's just like his influence on me is just like what I do now in Tattoo Billy is more to keep the members of the band that have passed away, because we've had two guitar players pass away and my father has passed away. And so I do it now, not just because of for me, but I do it for them too. I want them to be remembered and that, you know, they had a legacy, you know, even though it's not as huge and as popular and not everybody knows them in the household, but they got a following still. I mean, when I release stuff, I'm, you know, people stream it, people listen to it. I mean, just like the Frisky Whiskey video, you know, it's got Jonathan Joss. He was the voice of John Redcorn from King of the Hill cartoon and Badface from Tulsa King. So, I mean, this video is over 100,000 views now. So, you know, I'm keeping, by doing it still, I'm keeping the memory of these guys still alive, I feel like. So I kind of feel like it's a responsibility of mine to keep this thing going, just to honor their memory.
That's wonderful, Ed. That's people's legacy should be remembered. So why don't we hear Frisky Whiskey? Tell me, we're going to play that, but first tell us a little bit how that happened.
Well, it's kind of weird, but I was taking a shower and the whole song came to me in my head. And I got out of the shower, picked up the guitar, and immediately had it all within probably 8 or 9 minutes. And most of my songs are like that. I write everything. I don't force a song. A song's got to come to me naturally. I never sit down like, hey, I'm going to write a song about this, or I'm going to write a song about that. The song's just got to come to me. And Frisky Whiskey did. And it's about a song. And the song's about a guy who gets, you know, a divorce. His old, you know, his lady or his wife divorces him. He winds up getting a DUI and the whole guy's life's falling apart around him. And that's what the song's about. And the only part it's about me and the entire song is there's a breakdown part where it says, I'm looking back on looking back, listening to them records that my daddy bought. Because that's what I did. I go down and get through his records and see all the old country artists, like, you know, or even some of the old rock artists like Roy Orbison and all these guys and his records. And I'd listen to these records, you know, Waylon Jennings and, you know, Marty Robbins. And I would play these records and, you know, when I was a kid, just to check them out, you know. And so that part of the song is just about that, and that he's still out there. I think he's still happy that I'm keeping on the legacy, you know, the legacy of the band. So, you know, to me, it's an honor to be able to keep getting out and playing and writing songs.
Okay. So, Ed, right now you're on a roll, aren't you? Your band is doing very well. And your friend Caden Gordon, who referred you to me, is very happy with having you on his podcast, and you're getting around and getting to be pretty famous in a way in the country music circle. So have you met people that have influenced you to any great extent? And who would those people be?
As in influences, I don't think anybody's really influenced me like in songwriting. That I know of, unless it's something subconsciously. But there's a lot of artists that I like, but not a lot of them are country artists. You know, I listen to, like, I've mentioned them before in another interview just a couple of days ago, is a band called Blame My Youth. I've been listening to them. The guy that writes, you know, whoever's writing the lyrics and stuff in this band, I mean, just amazing lyrics, amazing melodies, and they're kind of an alternative rock band. So I kind of listen to everything. I mean, I even like Glenn Miller, you know, it sounds weird, but so every day to me is like different in music. I'm like, today I was listening to Alkaline Trio. Now later on tonight, I might be listening to Johnny Paycheck.
Okay.
So
your influence,
a wide variety.
Yeah. Well, and that's great. So true musicians are open to all kinds of music, really. Now, we're going. What's the other video we're going to play at the end now?
There's one. I'm sorry. I Can't Win for Losing.
Okay. And what's that about?
Well, I wrote that song, I think it was in 2003. And I remember as plain as the day, I had some, there used to be a group of Mormons. They used to ride around the neighborhood and they would always stop at my house. They'd come in, I'd give them water and, you know, and they came over for a visit and I gave them some water and we sat around and chit chat and, they left and it wasn't no more than 20 minutes later, the electric company cut my electric off. So I just felt like, and I wrote the whole song in the dark. Okay. With a candle, you know, playing as I can't win for losing, you know, because I always heard that saying from my people down in, they're all from Appalachian Mountains down in Kentucky and stuff. And that's where my dad was from.
I see.
And just one of those old sayings, I can't win for losing. And I was like, well, yeah. I can't win for losing today. My electric's cut off.
Oh, that's funny. Now, hold on. That's another one we're going to play after the interview. And what was the origin of that song?
That was the last song me and my dad was working on when he passed away. And so it was, I forgot a lot. I had to remake it a little bit because I couldn't remember all the lyrics he had to the song. And so that was the last song me and him kind of collaborated on. And I finished it up. And it was just a really, it was a, when he was alive singing it, my dad was just such a great singer.
Yeah.
Me, I'm more of a performer, I think, as a singer. He's a singer is like, he get up on stage, not change his vocals. Could sing a Percy Sledge song or an Isley Brothers song, and then sing a George Jones song and sing all these songs and sound great singing them and not change his voice. As in, I consider myself a one-trick pony. I can only do what I write, do what... And somebody said, I want you to sing this song. Like, I've had people say, you should get on The Voice. And I'm like, I couldn't do that. Okay. I was like, I can only sing and do what I can do.
Well, Ed, you do it very well. And I want to thank you so much for joining me today. And we're going to play... we're going to end up this interview with your music. And you should be very proud. And your dad is very proud, I'm sure, of the journey, the musical journey that you have been on and continue. And we wish you all the best and continued success. And thank you again for being on my show, For the Love of Words.
And thank you for having me. And everybody, keep on country rocking. My feet and all my pride. I can't.
won't you frizz me down? Lord, frizz me down. You got a new you frizz me down, low frizz me down, said frizz me down, 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 girl, frizz me down. That my daddy bought. There's an outlaw out there, I know that he still cares, and I'm out there and I'm running free. Frisky, frisky, drink a little whiskey. Frisky, frisky, drink a little.
My world apart. cold.